Most people know that UFOs repeatedly visited Washington, D.C. in the summer of 1952. But few people realize UFOs returned to D.C. 50 years later in the summer of 2002 and were photographed landing on Capitol Hill. Go up to the coasttocoastam.com website and have some fun there. Look at some of the items that our guest Robert Stanley has provided. No one knew how many times UFOs had been sighted in the nation's capital until now. In a moment, Robert Stanley, as we talk about close encounters on Capitol Hill. Former corporate journalist for Honda Research and Development at Torrance, California, Robert Stanley, currently the editor of Unicus magazine and the author of Close Encounters on Capitol Hill. He has passionately researched UFOs for more than 30 years, and in that time, he has interviewed dozens of eyewitnesses and leading experts. His ongoing investigation of UFOs has been featured on international television and radio and in print. Robert has traveled to over 50 countries in search of answers to ancient mysteries. He's our guest tonight on Coast to Coast AM. Hello, Robert. Welcome to Coast. How are you?
Doing well, George. How are you tonight?
My pleasure. Good. First-time guest, right?
Yes, sir. Thank you very much. I'm honored to be with you and your audience.
Likewise.
Tonight.
Great topic. Robert, first of all, tell me a little bit more about you beyond just the bio that I went through.
Sure. I was born and raised here in Los Angeles and grew up in Malibu. Very fortunate to live out there at Zuma Beach.
And it's gorgeous out there, isn't it?
It is, but, you know, a lot of my peers never really got to travel around as much as I did, so they, you know, it's, you don't really understand what the world is like until you get out and really experience it.
That's true.
That's one of the reasons that I'm so passionate about this, is because I've had so many bizarre experiences in my life, and, you know, it's kind of hard for me to imagine that all this is happening to me right now. I mean, the catalyst for all this is these photos that we're going to be looking at tonight. It's absolutely bizarre. It's almost like I stuck my finger in a light socket and I can't pull it out.
Well, you know, you have researched what I have always been wondering.
Yes.
Why in the heck nobody has done a thorough job about what very well could be one of the greatest UFO flaps that has ever occurred in this country?
You mean 1952?
Yeah.
Right. Well, I mean, there's a lot of people. Kevin Randall wrote quite a good book about it, but there is what most people don't realize. I didn't have a clue until I really started looking in depth into this. But 1952, they showed up 22 times, not two or three times. They were there 22 times, and
we're not talking about one object.
No, typically not. They usually come in groups, and you know the thing is they can range in size from anywhere. From the size of a gumball to the size of a city. And it's bizarre to think that these things have been hovering over Washington, D.C. now for, well, what I found is at least 156 years.
Well, back in the 50s, when this occurred in 52, and that would have been Eisenhower, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Did we send any planes up in the air? I mean, did we?
Oh, yeah.
What did we do?
Well, they were trying to intercept. The first intercept was 1948, and that didn't go well for the pilot. I mean, he didn't get killed, but later that year, earlier that year, Thomas Mantell actually was killed.
He was killed, yes.
Yeah, so it does happen. And it was literally like a dogfight. The only thing is that in 1948, the pilot didn't actually shoot at the UFO, but they were charging each other in the sky. It was just and of course, he was outmaneuvered at every point.
Oh, yeah, he could never catch it. Never.
No, and in 1952, when the radars were picking these things up and also looking out the window and seeing them visually, these were obviously not temperature inversion layers like the military offered that it's lame excuse after the fact. But the jets that went up to intercept, the UFOs would disappear. The jets would return to base, then the UFOs would reappear. So they were toying with us, and they were there for hours at a time, George. It's not like they just passed through and that was it.
Robert, it was after World War II. Did we think that these could be Soviet craft somehow?
Sure, they considered it, but the maneuverability, And the fact that they weren't attacking either, that's the part that absolutely befuddles the military, is what do these things want? Why do they keep showing up and toying with us like this?
Just hanging around, right?
Well, as far as we know, they're just, I think they obviously have, I mean, come on.
There's a mission.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, we just aren't privy to what it is.
Well, the mission could also be, here we are, you can't do anything about it.
That's what Commander Dean told me. I mean, according to what he read in the NATO assessment, yeah, that these flybys usually led to landings, and occasionally there was contact of some sort that ensued.
What got you interested in researching UFOs? I mean, it's not something one just wakes up and says, this is what I'm going to do for a living.
That is for sure. when I was just thinking about how I can tell this story briefly, but when I was young, my father had a picture of a UFO in his drawer. It was just a color slide. And I remember looking at that every once in a while and putting it back and thinking, gee, that's really weird. One day I put it inside a, do you ever remember the Kodak Viewmaster? It was like a handheld slide projector.
Yes, you push the slide down and squeeze the light
on. Exactly.
Yeah.
And boy, when I put that thing in there one day and I looked at it, my brain like caught on fire. I was like, wait a second, that is awesome. What is that thing? How could it be? So I started asking my dad questions, and he said, well, the photographer didn't see that at the time, but, you know, it's obviously there. And I said, well, how do you know it's really there? How come it's, you know, it's not a, somebody didn't fake that? And he says, well, because I actually took it to Life magazine and had it analyzed. And that's when I started really understanding that my dad had an interest in this. But he wasn't really vocal about it. It was just something on the side. And I just give you a reason why. He used to go to Giant Rock Airport with one of his pilot friends. They were both in the Self-Realization Fellowship together, and they knew one of their members had gone out to Giant Rock and was living there with George Van Tassel. So he had some exposure to it even before I was born. And like I said, that picture was in our family. So that was the initial catalyst that made me question, okay, wait a minute, how is it that something could be photographed and yet you can't see it with your eye? How in the world could that happen? And it took me many years before I came up with a satisfactory answer to that.
Two things affected me when I was younger, not about the paranormal world. That started when I was 11 or 12, but a couple of years later on, my mother brought home the book We Are Not Alone by Walter Sullivan, who was the New York Times science writer at the time. And she said, George, read this. Here's something for you. And I just couldn't put it down, Robert.
And what year was that, George?
Oh, that must have been 65, 66, 67, somewhere around there when that book first came out.
Mm-hmm.
And then Look magazine came out with the Barney and Betty Hill, The Interrupted Journey story. Remember that?
I do.
Those two issues, those two episodes in my life hooked me into wanting to research UFOs. I was a kid. I joined NICAP, National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena, which was located
in D.C.
And, you know, I had my little card, and, I mean, I got the information. I didn't realize at the time, Robert, that there were a lot of heavy hitters in that organization.
Oh, absolutely.
I thought it was like a kids' club for a while, and then I realized, hey, this is serious business.
Well, obviously. I mean, Rear Admiral Hillenkoetter was the first head of the CIA, and he headed up that department there at NICAP, but Major Donald Kehoe wrote quite a bit of stuff for articles and also books, and that's how I really fell deeply into the subject was when I was 13. I was going to junior high, and I walked into the library one day and saw that book, you know, and I read it, and I had to read it twice, and then that was it for me. I couldn't get enough, and I think I must have read every book ever published since that time.
I know Frank Edwards, Ruppolt's books, Hynek's books, everything. I mean, we have followed the same path.
Yeah.
Always, always looking for the possibilities that we've been, visited. There was a case that I just loved. It was in one of Frank Edwards' books. And it had to do with the missionary, and I think they were in New Guinea.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And they were waving
at the occupants. I mean, I loved it.
Yeah, I think it was Reverend Gill was his name.
Yeah.
He had some students with him, and they were up on whoever was in the craft was up on an observation deck, and they were, hey, I wanted to ask you, George, have you seen that new movie, Happy Feet?
No, I haven't seen that
one. Okay, I won't spoil it for you, but there is an incredible message in that movie for those of us who know that the extraterrestrials are here and that we need to communicate with them. It's really weird how they slip that in there to a kid's movie, but Boy, I couldn't recommend that movie more to people. It's
interesting.
A fantastic piece of work.
Okay, well, talking about piece of work, your work, Close Encounters on Capitol Hill, it's fantastic. And you know, and I've been telling people, this is not a political book here. We're not dealing with those kind of encounters on Capitol Hill. This is a great story.
Well put. It's not a red state, blue state kind of thing. But unfortunately, everything that happens in D.C. is political.
Yeah.
And what I found was when I talked to people there off the record, they were telling me, look, you're not going to get anybody to come on the record for your work, because the moment they do that, then they're going to be held accountable. And nobody wants to do that, not an individual, not an agency. They just don't want that albatross around their neck, which I kind of understand. But at the same time, here's my bottom line with this, is that I believe education is the key to our evolution. And as long as this information is being withheld from us, we really can't move on to the next level of our being.
Well, what astounds me about your work, and we'll talk about the 52 case again, because that's a great case. But
yeah,
your work is really based on the fact that something happened years later.
Well, something profound. And if we didn't have these photographs on film, then we probably, I would have never done the research, but the fact of the matter is that the person who took those pictures is a former ABC News photographer engineer, and he worked for them for 18 years. 8 of those years were at the White House. So he wasn't working for ABC News at the time. He had voluntarily retired because his father was dying from exposure to Agent Orange, unfortunately.
Yeah.
So he took some time off, and he was doing freelance work, and three times in 4 months, he accidentally captured pictures of UFOs in prohibited airspace in the middle of the heart of D.C., where he lives. And it happened on July the 4th when he was working for the city taking pictures of the skyline with the beautiful fireworks. It happened again on July 16th, and then it happened again later in November. But in the interim, there was all kinds of weird stuff going on. I mean, after the 10 days after they landed or filmed landing on the Capitol building, which we've got the pictures up there now, 10 days later, NORAD had to scramble jets to chase the UFOs out of the area.
Now, what was the media doing at the time, primarily radio and print?
You're talking about 2002?
2000, yes.
No, Fox News actually covered the event.
Oh, they did?
They're the only ones. And, you know, here's the thing. There's two independent DVDs that are being in production right now. One of them is by the former ABC News photographer. His name is Mr. Will Allen. And then also Rob Simone was out there recently with a film crew, and he's put together a documentary of the event. They actually found the landing zone for a couple of these objects, and the grass, George, the grass is still burnt to this day. They can't get anything to grow there. It's burned in these spherical...
that's an incredible story.
Well, here's the other part.
All right, but they must have shooed this away. I mean, this should be a major story, Robert.
Well, yeah, but at the same... Well, how do you break this to the general public? I mean, because, look, it's not like they can keep them out. And believe me, they've been trying over the years, and it's not working. And you can't shoot at them. That's not going to work, although they did.
But is there a need to shoot at them, first of all? I don't think so.
No, that's something that the CIA decided. There was a presidential order in 1950, I think it was 52, when Truman, he issued the order to shoot on site. And they quickly rescinded the order, but... There's been cases where guys just got an itchy finger and they went for it, and it was not always a good idea for them.
No, not very smart.
No, because they can defend themselves obviously when they need to.
Well, and they do so, based on what we've heard.
Yeah, but most of the time they just evade us because we're not anywhere near. I mean. Yeah, I know. There rumors are that we've developed some stuff covertly that's based on that, and I'm sure that's true to some degree. But, you know, I mean, what are you going to do? Bring out your covert flying saucer and go into a dogfight over D.C.?
Yeah, so,
that's not going to work either.
So they hold back. Now, were other people in the 2000-plus sightings, were other people witnessing this beyond the photographers?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, that's what floored me is when I started to – I mean, I knew – going into this, you know, researching this guy's claims that he had the film, but I wanted to get some background. And the more I looked, the more I found. And I was astounded at how many eyewitness accounts that were available. Most of these people have done this anonymously through different websites and publications. But my God, some of these things, they don't all happen at night either, George. They happen broad daylight and in front of dozens, if not hundreds, of people. And what are they going to see? But here's the problem, just like the military. What is the average person going to do with that event? Who do they tell, really?
Well, and I've got to say, I mean, this has happened after, right? Hmm? After all the tragedies, after the horror has befallen us.
I mean,
what were we doing? I mean, that now we've got missile launchers all over the place.
Oh, yeah, I see what you're saying. Yeah, after 9/11, yeah. 2001, yes, they increased security. They increased the prohibited, what's called P-51, is a prohibited airspace. And the center of that starts at the Washington Monument and expands out in a circular area. Then that's surrounded by restricted airspace. So it's by degrees, but you're right. After 2001, things got escalated as far as security, both in the ground and on the ground and in the air. Then in 2003, when we invaded Iraq, they increased the security even greater. And yet, in that period of time, there was over 3,645 what they called incursions. Now, we don't know if those are UFOs, but I kind of don't think they were all Cessnas. You know, it's just. And that I found there was a special committee meeting in D.C. that was convened just because they were trying to figure out how to coordinate. I mean, they're putting every agency under the sun on this, and they all coordinate through something called the NRCC, National Capital Regional Control Center. It's bizarre. I mean, how much stuff that I was able to dig up on this in about a year and a half. But
that's the time period you spent writing this book?
Well, yeah, because, okay, here's the thing. Daryl Sims sent me he forwarded me an email from the photographer Will Allen in D.C. with the photos and a brief summary of what happened. And Daryl sent that to me in spring of last year. And I looked at it and I thought, geez, that's amazing. How come I didn't hear about that? If this really happened, I mean, come on. I would imagine somebody would have reported it. So, but there was a phone number there for the photographer, Mr. Allen. So I figured, hey, I'll call him up. And he answered the phone. We started talking. And I think we've probably had over 1,000 phone conversations since that time, really. I mean, sometimes it's twice a day. I know my wife gets tired of me talking to the guy, but I'm so fascinated by the fact. I mean, here's the weird part. If you can, in fact, anybody can read the entire first chapter is all about Mr. Allen and his experiences, which includes the fact that he was abducted as a child when he was in England near Sculthorpe Air Force Base. You see, his father was a high-ranking Air Force officer, and so Mr. Allen was an Air Force brat, and he traveled around the country with, you know, his father, around the world, going to these different Air Force bases, right? So the first time he was abducted by Little Graves was when he was 4 years old. I forget exactly what year it was.
And they kept coming back.
Well, the next time it happened, he was outside Fort Dix in New Jersey, and near, and that place has a huge history. I mean, just like Sculthorpe and Lakenheath? Yeah, I think that's the one. Rendlesham, Lakenheath, Sculthorpe, they're all kind of in that central, they're
right.
Just a triangle of, and, you know, most people think that the Rendlesham thing was the height of the activity. It's not. It really was, it started back in the 50s. And they were shooting at them then, too. They were trying to intercept and shoot at them. And, I feel bad for those pilots because, you know, when they came back to base, they had dirty drawers from their experiences.
Oh, and told to not say anything.
Not only just told, they were threatened. You know, most of these guys have been threatened in various ways.
Did you get some people who talked to you off the record or on the record but not to reveal who they were?
Well, yeah. Yes, specifically, Mr. Allen has made, he, you know, having worked at the White House, he's got quite a few contacts. So his first impression was, after he developed the film, was to take it to the Capitol Police and inform them, hey, something went down here.
And they didn't know? The Capitol Police, they weren't aware of this?
Well, Yes and no.
All right, stay with us, Robert. We'll get to that in a moment when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, we're still looking for a few of you to sit in on our sci-fi pilot taping on Monday. Those of you in the greater Los Angeles area, you can email us at beintheaudience@yahoo.com. That's beintheaudience@yahoo.com. And I'll tell you what, those of you who have some great ghost stories, we'd like you to be part of the audience. Put your phone number in the subject line, please, okay? Because we're getting inundated with emails and we want to call you back. So ghost stories, put your phone number in the subject line. And then those of you who believe you might have been abducted, put your phone number in the subject line so the producers of the program can get back to you post-haste, because the pilot is Monday and you're to arrive at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. And our guest tonight on Coast to Coast is Robert Stanley. We're talking about his investigative work in his book, Close Encounters on Capitol Hill. And again, get up to the coasttocoastam.com website and take a look at some of the pictures that we are and have been and will be talking about. Robert, let's talk about. So Capitol Hill police were told about the UFOs on film, right?
They were shown one particular image that was taken on the Senate side of the Capitol, the 3.5-minute exposure. And that close-up is actually on your website, this green spherical thing with it's like a cloud of energy around
it.
There was four of those things, and they moved across the sky, generating a wormhole. At that time, the photographer was burned by the radiation emitted. I mean, his fingertips and the top of his head were a little bit scorched by that radiation.
And what was the distance, do you think, between the objects and the photographer?
He measured it out recently in the documentary. They did a bunch of measurements for all the different things, and it wasn't that far, though. I mean, the reason that he got burned, I mean, we know for sure UFOs emit radiation. There's a whole section in there, thanks to Captain Edward Ruppelt. He made it very clear that back in the 40s, they accidentally stumbled on the connection between radiation coming out of UFOs. But and we know for a fact that people and plants and cars and things have been burned by it. But when you generate a wormhole, from what I found in the scientific literature, is that theoretically, if we could do that, when it collapses, there's an exit, like a backwash of energy that spits out of that hole or tube, whatever you want to call it, and that's called Hawking's radiation. Theoretically, of course, and
theoretically,
obviously,
right.
They did it. Now, what's so weird about that picture is that it's a 3.5-minute exposure. It was taken just with ambient light, and it's like 1 o'clock in the morning. And he used a polarized filter over the lens. And what that allowed us to see is the energy spectrum of the craft, especially as they generated the wormhole. It looks like a fractal in the sky. It's the most bizarre thing I've ever seen in my career, and like I said, I've been at this for quite a while. It took us quite some time to even figure out what we were looking at. But yes, the Capitol Police were informed a few days after the event. Mr. Allen went there. He spoke with the detective division, and he showed them that image, and they displayed it on a very large screen, and they didn't know what to make out of it.
Were they interested in looking at it?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. They were very interested, and they didn't, like I said, they weren't sure what it was, and they tried to throw out some ideas like fireworks and stuff, and that didn't seem to fit. And Mr. Allen insisted that wasn't the case. And besides, you don't get radiation burns from fireworks.
Yeah, that's right. Plus, though, you know, if it was happening on somebody's watch.
Oh, God, if anybody did anything, the Capitol Police are on duty 24/7, and they do have security cameras working all the time. When they went back to check their security cameras, they found there was, These things didn't register on the camera for some reason. Now, part of the reason is that those are older digital cameras, and those things have been upgraded since, I can't say exactly what date, but they're in the process of upgrading that system. And confidentially, what Mr. Allen was told is that that wasn't the first time that they've had close encounters with the Capitol Police definitely know of more events. And in fact, some officers have had to write in their logs the events that transpired on their watch, and it severely disturbed them.
How would you rate Washington, D.C. as a location for UFO sightings compared to other spots on the planet?
Well, that's a good question, George. Part of my research, I came across Larry Hatch is a UFO statistician, and he had put on his website that Washington, D.C. has the highest UFO sightings per square mile of any place on the world, which I thought was a little odd until I contacted him, and he told me how he got the information. That was with only 50-some sightings over a 30-year period. And so, I got up to about 100 sightings in my database, and I thought, gee, that's a lot more than anybody else has ever found. But then I realized, there's probably a lot more that are just obscure, and I kept pushing and pushing until I found 224 eyewitness accounts within a 156-year period. And here's what's strange, and I knew this would happen, is that as soon as the book came out, more people started sending me information. So the account is now 224 and counting. I don't know if I'm going to go into a second edition or if I'm just going to publish updates in the Unicus magazine, but this information definitely needs to come out. In fact, one of your listeners emailed me a photograph that his father took in front of the Capitol building in like 1949 or 1950, and that's on my the front page of my website. And it's just a black and white photo, but there's clearly a couple of UFOs over the dome.
That's exciting.
It's wild stuff.
Now, you have interviewed, or you have a number of eyewitness accounts of D.C. sightings, right, in your book?
Yes, over 200.
All right, let's take a couple of them. Give me some of the juicy ones.
Well, the daytime ones are what I think is probably the most compelling from most recently. Hold on a sec. Looking in here.
All right.
There have been accounts here where literally dozens of people were stopped in their car during, like, this one was July 11th. Something about July. I don't know why everything goes crazy in July, but...
And the 11th.
But specifically July in D.C. seems to be a very busy time. But there's this woman is a very credible individual, and she said she was stuck in traffic on Rhode Island Avenue about 11 a.m. on a Saturday morning, bumper-to-bumper traffic, and she saw something in the sky. She said it looked like a star. But then the star started descending, okay? And she said it came down out of the sky. She said it was a very large silver metallic dome circular UFO, hovered for about 10 minutes above the tree. About the size of a football field. It hovered and then sped away silently. She said it was shiny like aluminum foil, but was so shiny it was almost looked like liquid. The treetops were even reflecting in the metal. It hovered very close to me as I drove down Rhode Island Avenue. The traffic was very busy, so I wasn't going anywhere. She said I looked up, and she said she knew other people could see it too because they were looking up at it. And she said it really gave her the creeps. And, at one point she started thinking, please go away. And immediately after that, the thing began to slowly pick up speed and move back up into the sky. But that was 1993. In 1992, this one's really weird, is in the afternoon, so it's still daytime, April 13th, 1992, on the mall, dozens of people, right? I mean, that place is always crammed with tourists. And according to this English family that was there on holiday, dozens of people started pointing up at the sky because they were looking at this very large UFO. It was a very large, bright, disc-shaped UFO floating silently at approximately 30,000 feet over the heart of Washington, D.C. Following that huge UFO were 10 smaller UFOs that were shining brightly as they passed over the Washington Monument Complex, which is located directly behind the White House. So... those are just in the 90s. I mean, the things that happened, of course, what happened in just this decade are probably the most profound. And, like I was trying to say to you, that the timeline is really incredible, that after they landed on the 16th of July, 2002, they showed up 10 days later and were chased out. That's the 26th. They showed up again on the 30th and were chased out again. then in September of that year, minister and his wife and some friends were visiting D.C. The wife said, "Oh, honey, please pull over. I want to take a picture of the Capitol."
Right.
So they take the picture. It's 9 o'clock at night. They go back to their hotel room and download the pictures. And lo and behold, there's a UFO over the Capitol Dome. Now, he said, it was really interesting. He said, I'm not going to post this on the internet because I think this might be worth some money. So I've been trying to find his character. I don't know where he is. He's somewhere in Texas.
Nobody's bought his pictures yet. I don't. Well, maybe somebody did.
No, I haven't seen it, but I'm sure.
To keep it quiet.
Yeah, you know, I'm sure at some point it'll surface. But then in December 16th, 2002, they showed up. The UFO showed up again during the daytime. The military scrambled jets again. And this time somebody on the ground saw it, and who lived in D.C., and she was a former Air Force brat too. And she was very familiar with aircraft, and she said when she looked up, she saw the aircraft, and then she saw this other thing, and it was hovering very low over the buildings. And she said, obviously the jets couldn't catch it. It was too low. And then
they escape? Why don't they just stay there? I mean, they can't be shot down, I don't think. So
wait a second. Hold on, George. They have been shot down, but you're touching on a very, very sensitive subject. In 1952, when the orders were issued, yes, there was a small, I mean a very small, like 2-foot-wide disc that was shot at, and a piece of the metal was knocked off of it, which was later analyzed. But I don't think anybody was in that. That was one of those sort of drones
a robotic craft.
Yeah, and it's picking up information, and I guess they got a lucky shot or whatever, but my point being is that there have been many larger craft with individuals in it that have been shot at by us. But then there's the other ones, George, that just fall out of the sky, and they've obviously been damaged by something.
Like Roswell.
Yeah, and also Farmington. And there's many cases where you have to wonder who the heck shot that thing down. It wasn't us, especially back in the 40s and 50s. In fact, this is not going to even sound plausible. The first UFO that was ever shot down that I know of in recorded history was 1917 by Baron von Richthofen, the Bloody Red Baron, in Belgium.
He shot one down?
Yeah, he did. I mean, according to his wingman, that's what happened. Early one morning, they were on patrol over Belgium in their Trifokker aircraft. And those guns were, I mean, those guys didn't mess around. Those were they really flying some heavy lead coming out of those things. And when they saw this thing, they immediately assumed it was enemy aircraft, and he was a deadeye, and he just started shooting at the thing, and it fell like a rock out of the sky, and then it crashed into the woods. And according to his wingman, he says that a couple of little bald-headed guys got out and ran off into the forest. Well, at the time, they figured, you know, we had just entered the war,
right,
being the U.S., and they thought, and that was World War I, by the way, folks. These German guys thought that that was our stuff
and our guys.
But at the how would they know any different? 1917.
You wouldn't.
Yeah. Who heard of UFOs or aliens?
Right.
Come on. But after the fact, this is many years later. He said back in the 50s, it started dawning on him that what the Baron had shot down was clearly not ours. You know, it wasn't anything ever built on Earth.
Who confiscated it? The Germans?
Well, he didn't say, because after they shot it down, they just returned to base. I mean, they were ordered not to talk about it. But yeah, I would assume the Germans would have gone after it. And
where'd the little occupants go?
How would I know that? I would have to assume they were picked up.
By their own?
Yeah, I would imagine. So yeah, because these things never fly alone.
No, that's true.
You know, they're always.
See, I've always wondered why Roswell occurred the way it reportedly did,
mm-hmm.
and why the extra ships that must have been around didn't pick them up fast.
It's a good question. According to Daryl Sims, and he studied this quite a bit, he said that was a Trojan horse, that they wanted us to acquire that technology and that biological entity.
Interesting.
Yeah, well, it's a lot more complicated than people think. And I heard it, you know, there's a very popular talk show host who will remain nameless that has a conspiracy show once a month. And he was trying to say the other day that the Roswell thing was all bunk, and that people really didn't start talking about it until like the 60s, and there's no such thing as aliens. But the truth of the matter is, I found in my book that there was plenty of people back even in the 30s that had close encounters with aliens, not just UFOs, but
right. We aliens. Look, we just didn't have media right. as widespread as we have today that would have allowed that. I mean, we all know in Roswell, the Air Force themselves released a report that said we have picked up a crashed saucer. Mm-hmm. And then they backtracked right away. They changed it. But, I mean, I remember seeing Walter Hauck holding up a article mm-hmm. of a newspaper mm-hmm. that says, UFO, what was it, Air Force or UFO is captured.
Well, but, so this is the problem, though, George. What do we do with these things, even if we can catch them? It's not like...
We haul them off to Wright-Patterson or Area 51.
Right, but that's what I said about education. There's a treasure trove of information that's being withheld from the general population, and that's not fair to us.
No, and it always will be, I'm afraid.
Well, that's why I say we go do an end run around these guys, honestly. I think it's about time that people put democracy into action, and if you want to take a minute, we can talk about this event that I'm promoting. I just loosely call it, for now, we're calling it CosmicConcert.com.
Cosmic Concert?
Yeah, CosmicConcert.com. And what it's going to be is an event where we have...
You're inviting the Star Wars group from the bar, right?
Well, it's you know how there's benefit concerts and stuff.
Yeah.
But think like American Idol. There's a theme here. I guess we probably should call it Alien Idol. But the idea is we want to get artists and authors to show up at a location and put on a little show to entertain people, but at the same time you're educating them about the events that have happened and how we really are being visited, and ultimately the goal is to take a vote electronically from everybody on the planet who wants to participate. And it's a very simple question, George. Should extraterrestrials be allowed to visit or welcome to visit our planet?
Yeah, as long as they don't eat us, like the old Twilight Zone show, to serve man.
Obviously not. Nobody would welcome that. I'm just saying, let's just assume that the ones we would welcome are benevolent.
Absolutely.
Okay, so that's the big issue here. We've never put out the welcome mat.
Bring them on.
Well, you can't, and besides, you can't expect the government or the military to do that. It's not the way that the good guys work, as far as I know. They are more democratic, more utopian. So they would, I think, I'm almost positive that they would respond to an event like that. And if we get a simple majority of the vote says, yes, we would welcome you to visit us, I think that's when they will show up overtly. Because obviously they're here covertly, both good and bad.
So you believe that if there's a massive public appeal
for
them to just come down, don't mm-hmm. worry, show yourself.
Well, I wouldn't say don't worry, because there's obviously going to be opposition to this.
And someone's always going to try to shoot them down.
In fact, there's a friend of my sister, when she was in Colombia, she was abducted, and I don't really like that word, because most of the people that are taken are returned. But there are quite a few, unfortunately.
Yeah, but how many are they taken, under their own willpower? Probably not.
No. So, yes, abduction.
So they are abducted.
Yeah, but they are returned. Here's why I don't like that term, is because when humans abduct other humans, you usually never come back.
Well, yeah, some people get kidnapped and returned. It's still a kidnapping.
Well, kidnapped, and maybe that's a better word. I don't know, because, like I said, these people are, most of the people we know about are returned intact, more or less. What disturbs me, though, George, is I have found out recently, though, that some people are taken and never returned, and it's not like they're put into vats for food. They're literally taken off this world to colonize other worlds.
See, and that's where David Jacobs comes in. He's a staunch believer in this. He will be a guest, by the way, on Coast to Coast on Friday the 14th.
Oh.
We'll be back in a moment with our guest, Robert Stanley. We're going to go back now to 52 and come forward, and he's got some astounding things to say.